There is a special form of special food founded by God into the church, which had to result in the primacy of the church. It was inevitable that the church had to develop along the lines of papal primacy. This is God's will and God's plan. It is a seed planted by God through Christ in St. Peter. And that's when the Roman Catholic Church talks about papal primacy. They always mean very precisely and very specifically Pauline primacy. They don't want to talk in terms of general apostolic authority. We use that term in the first quarter quite regularly. But the Roman Church means the fact that God will, that Peter from the very beginning, be the unquestioned head of the church, and that the acknowledgement of this primacy of Peter and his victors was essential to salvation. When the Roman Catholic historian studies the history of the papacy, it is his concern to demonstrate how inescapably this development had to take place. It is the will and plan of God that Peter in Rome be supreme, and that the whole church, at least the Western church, take its orders and its directives from him. The pontiffs exist, will, and promote their activities as representatives of Christ, whom they perpetuate visibly down through the ages. Actually, you find a certain confusion in the thinking of Catholic theologians as to whether the Pope is the vicar of Christ or the vicar of Peter on earth. You find both expressions, and in the more recent Catholic writers, you find them talking more about the Pope as the vicar of Peter, and vicar in the full etymological sense of the word. One who stands there in the place of Peter, one who is actually Peter, and has the mind and the will and the personality of Peter. So that's the question I think that we have to ask as one goes through the historical development of the church. Is it obvious that there was a seed planted by God from the very beginning which made the papal hierarchy inevitable and which gives the papal hierarchy God's full blessing? To go way back to the very beginning then, and again, to take just a brief look at Clement of Rome. You recall his epistles and his letters and the extended discussion that I'm sure all of us had in the first quarter, concerning the reasons why Clement inserts his authority into the Corinthian church. And having gone over the epistle in some detail, we concluded that Clement had no reason by virtue of the fact that he was Bishop of Rome for doing this. Here a quotation from a 1960s Catholic historical study of papal primacy might be in order. I'm quoting from a very recent study that I know of, specifically of the development of papal primacy, and he says this, quote, "Not even strictly speaking, a proof of a Roman primacy, because there is no trace of this in any part of the text." This is the most recent Catholic evaluation of the first epistle of Clement. But we can't say that Clement proves that the Pope, that the Bishop of Rome at that time was in a position of primacy. The fact remains that Clement did take a very strong interest in the affairs of the Corinthian church. Now, I'd like to suggest as an alternative thesis to this one that we just suggested from the Roman Catholic Church, namely, that from the very beginning, the leaders of the Roman church visualized themselves as leaders of the universal church, at least the universal church in the West, and that this pattern is apparent from the very beginning, and that it's simply a human decision. I want to say that the decision can be absolutely sincere. I'm not suggesting any kind of Lord, ask an idea that these men would follow hungry. That may have been true in some cases, and certainly is evident in the later history of the church. But that the leader of the Roman church, seeing himself in the two cities, simply said to himself from the beginning and passed this idea on to all of his successors, the logical pattern for the church's development is the pattern of Roman primacy. And then, almost deliberately, I think you can see this evidence, almost deliberately set themselves to sell the church on this idea and principle that the good health of the church, the effective administration of the church, the protection of the church against heresy requires one strong head of the church. You can't be strong if you have 100 different heads, each running their own way. I think the picture becomes an illustration of this thing that we've been talking about, the conviction in the minds of the Roman bishops that they have a particular responsibility to give leadership to the church. But this is not in the mind of the church. It's the Roman conviction manifested here in Victory that the welfare of the church demands very tight discipline, the old naval expression of running a very tight ship. This is a reflection of the Roman mind, and it's interesting to note that, according to Jerome, Victor is the first real Roman who occupies the sea. He's the first man to use Latin, says Jerome. All previous occupants of the sea have been Greek-speaking and Greek-thinking individuals. The observation has been made, and I think it's extremely significant, that all of the bishops who made a real contribution to the development of the primacy of the Roman See had either themselves been Latin or had been entirely devoted to the service of the Roman Church. There is in the Roman mind then an insistence upon order, an insistence that things be done legally, neatly, and this is the only major see in the church whose leaders have this mental set. The Easterners are freewheeling, somewhat disorganized, they're happy in their studies, they're not great administrators. The Roman bishops all had this training in administration and this realization of the importance of good type administration. I wonder whether as much as anything else it isn't a working out of the Latin genius that we see in the gradual development of the Roman primacy. The next man who called to the witness stand is Cyprian, the bishop of North Africa. We really have to say two things about Cyprian. As Protestants, we like to say that Cyprian rejected the right of the Roman bishop to interfere in his local affairs, and that's true. Cyprian says a number of times that each bishop is responsible for the administration of his own diocese as unto God. And so long as he can stand before God with a clean conscience, what he does is his own business, and nobody has the right to step in and tell him how to do it. Cyprian does say that. Cyprian does also say, on the other side of the fence, that the unity of the church does derive from the Roman church. That the Roman church is, so to speak, the mother church, and she is the fountain and source of ecclesiastical unity. You see, there is in Cyprian already a very definite willingness to accept the unique position of the Roman Church. Now, we certainly don't touch anything in any way if we deliberately misuse evidence or deliberately leave significant evidence out of the picture. Cyprian does have a very high regard for the Roman Church as the source of unity within the Church. A number of minor witnesses then to this gradual development, they talk like Dionysius, 259 to 269, important for a number of reasons. You may perhaps recall that this bishop took it upon himself to criticize the theological stand of his namesake in Alexandria. He wrote to him and said, "It sounds to me like you're teaching Sabellianism." And Dionysius of Alexandria felt constrained to write back to Dionysius of Rome, defending the orthodoxy of his position. So you see that by this period, there is a desire on the part also, at least of the Alexandrian bishop, to be in harmony with the teaching of the bishop of Rome. Okay. Okay, to move on then with some of the other individuals who evidently somewhat important. In the whole period of the Bavarian controversy, there was a strong political overtone in Bavarian, in that the emperors were, the Eastern emperors now, were usually Bavarian in their theology. The Roman bishops were orthodox in their theology. The Roman bishops, again, in an attempt to salvage orthodoxy, frequently find themselves trying to resist the Eastern emperor, and often enough successfully. For example, Julius, 337 to 352, because he represents the orthodox tradition, plays a very strong role in church history at this time. On one occasion, Athanasius is chased out of the East, Julius welcomes him to the West, and thereby again understood the continuing orthodox history of the Roman See. Julius is the man who made such a profound impression upon the church leaders, East and West, or the primarily West, that when they met in council at Sardica in 333, I'm sure you recall this church council, among the canons passed at Sardica were a number of canons which, in effect, gave to the Roman bishop the right to finally judge in any cases of issue between a number of bishops. If two men disagreed, the Roman bishop would be the final court of appeal for the dissatisfied litigant. This is established in Sardica in 333, now more than 300 years after the ascension of Christ. The Roman church, in an attempt to underscore the significance of the Sardican decree, always attached these to the Nicene decrees as AD 325. And after Constantinople, 50 years later, when they're arguing the question of a apostolic jurisdiction, the Roman representative said, "This was settled at Nicaea within the Nicene decree." And the Eastern bishop said, "Well, let's just check the record. They got out 4 minutes from Nicaea. There were no apostolic resolutions in the Nicene minutes. And they finally then did find them in the Sardican minutes." But again, you see, the Roman bishop realizes the extreme significance of the Sardican decree. And so, and here again, there's no suggestion of evil motive. They attach them to the Nicene minutes so that they come from an ecumenical council, not from a regional or provincial council. Under a man like Dionysius, 366 to 384, the Emperor Theodosius made communion with Rome a sign by which Christians were to be recognized. Those who were in communion with Rome were entitled to state support. Those who were not in communion with Rome would receive no favor, no support from the Roman See, the Roman Empire. You see, again, here's the practical problem. If they're going to use money to build a church, the Arians want a church built in town, and the Athanasians want a church built in town. Whom do we give the money to? Theodosius happened to be an anti-Arian emperor, and since the Roman See had this long history of anti-Arian theology, he simply said that those who are in communion with Rome get the money to build the church. Those who are not have to have their own fundraising job. It is Dionysius who is the first to use the expression that Rome is the Fides Apostolic. Rome is the apostolic see, and for that reason, it should receive primacy from the entire church. Now, no, this is 300 years after the return of Christ to heaven, that this specific claim was first made and developed in full. Some of the other evidence now, to go into some of the church fathers of the 4th and 5th century for just a moment. Basil the Great, from Asia Minor, who died in 380, generally granted the right of the Roman Church to intervene in other churches' affairs. But interestingly enough, when it came down to the affairs of Antioch, which were very close to Basil's house, he rejected the right of the Roman Church to intervene in the Antiochene affairs. So you cannot cite Basil the Cappadocian as supporting the principle of Roman primacy and the idea of obedience to the Roman Pope, although the Catholics like to fight him in that connection. Ambrose, a Westerner, a Roman mind, a tremendous influence in the church. Now I'm quoting again from Jersey, the book that I mentioned yesterday, the most recent Catholic study of primacy, says, "One looks in vain for any explicit reference to the Church of Rome as possessing a universal jurisdiction." This is the Catholic interpretation of Ambrose, this great Western leader. You can't find in Ambrose any statement that the Roman Church possesses any universal jurisdiction by any divine right. But Ambrose does also say, "Whatever you condemn, we too shall condemn. Because in your words, we have found the solicitude of the good shepherd. Therefore, you deserve to be heard and followed by the faithful of the Lord." You see, Ambrose reflects much the same position as Christian. We see no divine jurisdiction. But we have found the Roman Church to be a good and faithful leader, generally speaking. And so we listen very carefully and very respectfully to what you have to say. We have always seen in you a real want of concern for the other churches, going all the way back to Clement. And so we listen to you. But we do not do this because this is the apostolic see, or because this is the will of God, but this has worked out well for the church in the past. Augustine is cited in many Catholic studies as the author of the phrase "Roma locuta, causa fomita fari." But let's look again at precisely what Augustine said in this connection. In his sermon number 131 on the Pelagian heresy, Augustine said to his congregation, "With regard to this question," namely the Pelagian heresy, "the deliberations of two councils were sent to the Apostolic See, and three positions have now been received. Therefore, the dispute is over, and may God also spread the end of error." Now, this has been summarized to read, "Roma locuta, causa fomita error." But I think that as we listen to it, otherwise you find little in Augustine concerning Roman primacy. And again, you remember that historically North Africa and Rome were very, very close to each other, and that North Africa was undoubtedly founded from Rome and had the feeling of a daughter for a mother. So at any time we could expect to find a strong sense of Roman primacy that would be in North Africa. But we don't find it in Scythian or in Augustine. The next Pope, now moving out of the Fathers, back into the historical development of the Pope, this man, Siricius, that I mentioned just a minute ago, S-I-R-I-C-I-U-S, 384 to 399, was the first one to regularly issue decretals, which are supposed to settle the issues in the various congregations that come to him for advice. In a letter to a certain bishop of Taranga, Siricius said this: "The Apostle Peter lives personally in the Bishop of Rome. If the Pontiff bears the responsibility of all those who are in need of his help, he is certain that the Blessed Apostle bears it with him and in him." Here you find the first early specific development of the concept of vicarious custody. The Apostle Peter lives personally in the Bishop of Rome. If the Pontiff bears the responsibility of all those who are in need of his help, he is certain that the Blessed Apostle bears it with him and in him. Innocent is a big man in this development. Innocent, in one of his decretals, has this interesting statement. This is Innocent 401-417. "You consider the Church of Rome as the head of the body of which you are a part." Now there's another interesting study. The most difference between what the bishops of Rome say about themselves in answering the letters and about what the authors of the letter said when they wrote to the Bishop of Rome. Again, a church will say, Leo, the Wilson has been baptized, will you help us out? And then here, innocent answers, you have written to the church which is the head of the body of which you are a part. And the letter addressed to the Bishop of Rome didn't say that in any way at all. But I think, again, it's part of this Roman policy to continually emphasize its position of primacy and authority in every way possible. Incidents of this sort that lead me to feel that this is a part of the theme of all potential candidates for the Roman bishopric, this idea of assert your Roman primacy at every opportunity. Again, we're not in any way suggesting evil, sinister motives on the part of these Roman bishops, but that this was the goal. This was the essential mode of training which the potential bishops received in Rome. Gregory says, innocent, Rome is an incorruptible fountainhead whose waters are brought everywhere. It's not until the end of the 5th century that these decretals, from which we have now been quoting, begin to be collected. And it's a certain Dionysius Exiguus, E-S-I-G-W-S, who makes the first collection of these laws and rules of the Bishop of Rome. Now this strikes me too as very significant. If these laws and rules were so essential for the church, why were they not collected until 500? All of the early letters and decretals had been lost, and they were supplanted then by the Pseudo-Isidorian decretals. But if this were the will of God for the church, that the Roman bishop be the theological leader of the church, why is all of their theology, all of their authoritative decretals lost, and why are they not collected until we get down to AD 500? This takes us into the last of the two Gregorian men, and that's Leo the Great, 404 to 461.